哎呀！
So can we go around the circle with names? Because I can never remember even my own name these days.
Ritu.
Brit.
Dawn. Jeffrey.
Samuel.
Forrest.
Isaiah.
Wendy.
Angie.
Hi. I'm in a bit of a quandary. Because I came in this year with the intention of talking about being in the present moment. And I just had this 2-week retreat on being in the present moment, the khandhas, you know, the empty ones at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, and not self. So it's like I came in at this level, and all of a sudden the bottom has dropped out. And that's 2 days ago I got off retreat. So I may be even more incoherent than usual. The original talk, the original intention, was to emphasize the importance of being present with those aspects of ourselves that we really don't often want to see. Now, why would we want to do that? The anger, the jealousy, the fear, the irrationality, the resentment, the bitterness, the despair, all the stuff that we think we shouldn't have. All the stuff that when we see, we blame ourselves for having. So we're sitting along in meditation and all of a sudden anger arises out of nowhere. Anybody ever have that happen? Well, what do we do? Well, first thing we can do is judge it and say how bad a meditator we are, because we shouldn't have that happen. Anyone do that? Another thing we can do is pretend it's not there. That's always good. Third thing we can do is we can go into the topic of it, right? I'm angry at this because of, we can like spend 20 minutes on that and go in a flash. And pretty soon it's time to stand up and the meditation period's gone. It's you. There are other possibilities that are, in the end, more wholesome. And the first thing they involve is getting rid of that story. It doesn't matter why you're angry. Not for the purposes of meditation. We don't meditate so we can, conduct mental arguments with people who have offended us. Because it doesn't get us anywhere. It took me years and years and years and years to believe that. And variants of it. other ways of telling stories and trying to fix things and figure out problems and all that. In the Vipassana tradition, we have certain strategies for turning our attention towards the anger itself as an experience in our body. What does this anger feel like? I mean, first I notice I'm angry. I try to notice in a kind way. Why would I want to be kind to myself for being angry? You ever try to fight with an angry 2-year-old? Someone here has to be calm. So we need to be very gentle. We need to be very compassionate with the existence of the anger. We need to hold it in some kind of safety. Because the anger is there. It's not going to go away by our pretending. And it's certainly not going to go away by our fighting with it. So, and it's not going to go away by our fueling it. You know. Or deciding how right we are to be angry. It's just there. And it's there as an experience in our bodies. Our bodies including our minds and hearts. So what do? We turn towards the experience itself. Where is this anger in my body? And it's not always going to be the same place. Sometimes it's going to be here, sometimes it's going to be here, sometimes it might be in your left toenail. I mean, it's amazing how many places an upsurge of unwanted feeling can find to lodge. But what we do is we see it. The first thing is the moment we turn our attention away from the subject that we're angry about or the judging it, and we stop pretending it's not there. And we turn our attention to the actual experience. Then we bring ourselves where we are. We bring ourselves into the present. I'm very fond of saying, both to my staff and in the expat group I lead on Sundays, you know, our minds and our bodies are always in these different places. And we can't take our bodies to where our minds are. And if we did, our minds would go somewhere else. So what we're working on is how to bring our mind back home. And we're not going to bring our mind back home if we provide it with a hostile environment. So if we've got anger going on, we've got to have a place for it to rest safely. And then of its own, it will eventually find a way to loosen itself and to leave. In the Hungry Ghost Ceremony, we don't beat up on the ghosts. We feed them sweet rice and flowers. You do Hungry Ghost here? Yeah. What do? Stand there with a stick and beat the ghosts over there? That's what they do in Cambodia, and then when you get old and tired, the ghosts come back to watch the garden and beat you up. I had one of my staff members had a grandfather who was a very famous sort of ghostbuster. And then the last months of his life were hell. The house was shaking. Windstorms would be blowing, you know, filth into the house when there was no wind in the rest of the village. The middle of the night, there'd be these weird sounds. You know, and what everybody said is, you know, now that you're weak, the ghosts are coming back to get you. That's not how we do it. That's not how we do it in my project either. We do it, this is the one thing that I've really imported from Zen into the Buddhism that we practice in Cambodia, and that's that we recognize the ghost as some unsatisfied residual that needs to be held and loved and then can set itself free. So, in all of these unwanted states of mind that come up, and they inevitably come up with this thing. Everything comes up with this thing. Our job in meditation is to allow them to be seen. Is to allow ourselves to be fully present so that they can be fully present. And then when they're fully present, they can go somewhere else and something else can be fully present. And something else can be fully present. And the reverse, of course, happens with the great stuff. You know, oh God, I'm having such a blissful meditation. I'm really going to hold on to it. You know, the moment we grasp, you know, it's not there. So this business of being present is intimately connected with the business of not self. That what's present is not what's present is simply what's there. I know that sounds like a redundancy, but it's not me, and maybe I should have worn a different outfit, and you know, it's not maybe, you know, it would be better if my back was straighter, or you know, I didn't sneeze during meditation, or, you know, it's seeing all that as part of what goes through us in the meditative process, what we breathe through in Soto Zen. We simply bring our attention back to our breath, again and again and again. And as the pain comes up and we breathe through it, eventually it lessens. And as the anger comes up and we breathe through it, we give it space. You know, after the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara, delusion, used to come and visit. You know that? Everybody knows the story a million times, right? You know, and the students would try it, and the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis would say, oh, Mara, go away, go away, go away. And the Buddha would say, no, come on in, come on in. Right here. Yeah. And then the Buddha would say, Mara, I see you. And Mara would go away again. My teacher, Gil Fronsdell, tells a story about when he was on retreat in Thailand, that he'd been there about 6 or 7 weeks at the edge of the monastery in a little hut, you know, with a very strict meditation schedule, seeing his abbot once a day at the end of the day. And one day, for no special reason, he decided to walk around the monastery. So he's walking around the monastery, and guess who he runs into? I mean, he got busted. There's the abbot. And the abbot's like 50 feet away, looking at him. And Gil says, there was no judgment at all about, you know, why aren't you in your kuti meditating like you're supposed to be, you know, there was just the seeing. And that seeing was so complete that it brought him peace about that. He said he'd never in his life felt seen in that way. Just completely and totally accepted for who he was. And that seeing was transformative. So as we sit and these things come up and we breathe through them and we see them, then we provide not only the space to come home to, but for transformation. So I guess that's what I got to say today, which is, that the space of being present is large enough to hold everything. And to hold it compassionately and with clarity and to allow it all to be present. We don't have to be anything in particular. We just have to be here for it. And then we allow the world to be exactly as it is. Okay, questions? Did any of that make sense? It's a little abstract. Last year you got me 2 days off the plane. This year you get me 2 days at a retreat. Some questions, we've got some time. Yes?
Maybe talk a little bit also about what happened last year. I don't know if everybody knows what you do. I think most of us do, but a couple of you. I don't know if Sasha knows.
Okay. We've got this project in Cambodia. We've had it for 14 years now, where we started with chaplaincy for destitute AIDS patients. And over the years, the epidemic changed, and for many years it got better, and then the government took over and it got worse, and has continued to get worse, and it's been a very hard year that way for all of us, because we've had another level of collapse in the system. So at this point we provide not only chaplaincy, which means emotional and spiritual support, chanting. My staff not only knows regular chanting, but there's a beautiful melodic form of Cambodian chanting in the vernacular that tells stories from the Buddha. And it is really complicated to do. And if I try to do it, it sounds like someone's torturing a cat. But they're wonderful at it. And it's designed. You know, there's a person who's been studying it. Who's at Berkeley now? Designed to bring up painful emotion and to heal it. So they do a lot of that. And that's our center. We do Reiki, we do healing touch, We do a lot of listening. We do a certain amount of social work intervention, hooking people up with organizations. And increasingly more material aid. This year, material aid. We provide transportation money so that some 350 patients can get their medicines. The medicines are free, but they can't get there. We provide rice and fish sauce twice a year to about 700 people this year. All our transportation patients and a couple of organizations. And one hospital. We provide monkey balm. Most of you know it as tiger balm. Monkey balm is a little bit sharper and is used for everything. We provide soy milk for people who can't eat. We don't have a facility. We go to the hospitals, we go to the hospices, we go to people's homes, we go where they are. Right now we're supporting we use 10 cases of soy milk a week for people who can't eat. So it's like a can a day, a person. We started providing medicines to the National AIDS Hospital because the government hasn't been providing. There's an expensive medicine for cryptococcal meningitis that we've been involved with for a few years. But this year what's happened is that the hospital has run out of ordinary medicines like anti-diarrhea pills. So every month they give us a list and we go and fill it. We're lucky to be able to do that. We go to two prisons. We feed about 75 men in the men's central prison with AIDS, with tuberculosis, with cancer, with other serious conditions. One guy from Bangladesh who has no family and no nothing. Anybody over 70 years old. And the women in adolescence prison, we were feeding about 10 people, the elderly and the TB, and boys with AIDS, and another organization was feeding the women with AIDS, and a third organization was taking care of pregnant and breastfeeding women. Well, both of those organizations dropped out, so now we've got about 60 people in that prison. Lots of new babies. Some of the women were not pregnant when they went into the prison. We took all that over in June when MSF left, so we're still sorting out how to do it effectively. We build houses sometimes. What don't we do? Our job. You know, we're dealing with people who are hideously marginalized and suffering from diseases that, well, we have the same attitudes in this country. And our real job is to allow them to understand that they are at the center of the Buddha's compassion. So we do whatever we can to help that happen. And sometimes we succeed. And sometimes we just feed people. So we've got about 550 patients in all that we see on a regular basis for all the programs. And we've got about, well, we've got 9 staff and me. 8 of the staff are chaplains, and 1 is the person who runs around giving the money to people, with 15 people coming a day for medicines in 5 different hospitals. And every day he gets the list and the cash for each person and runs around and hands it out. And I run around and do all the shopping. And my staff gets to see patients, except our director, who has to manage all of it. So we've broadened from AIDS a lot. One of the very, very hard things this year is that when the government took over in 2010, the educational systems collapsed about AIDS. And we increasingly see people 5 days. It's been happening for a few years, but now it's the bulk of the patients we see in the hospital are near death and never knew they had AIDS. You know, we had a family in one of the hospitals. He had cryptococcal meningitis. That's a fungus that lives in your body that goes wild when your immune system collapses. And sometimes it goes into your lungs, and sometimes it goes into your esophagus, and sometimes it goes into your armpits and groin. And a lot of time it goes up the spine into the lining of the brain, and you get this hideous headache, and it can kill you pretty fast, but not fast enough for the level of pain. And we've been providing medicine for that since about 2011, because medicine's expensive. So we've got these people coming in with cryptococcal meningitis. We've got this, he doesn't know he has AIDS. They got married 5 months ago. She's 2 months pregnant. They spent all of their money at a private clinic that never even tested him for AIDS. I mean, that's the kind of situation we're looking at all the time now. And the government has not had any of the amphotericin B is the serious medicine for cryptococcal, and it costs basically $20 a day. I know that's not much here, it's a lot in Cambodia. It's more than most people, you know, more than many people, if not most people, have for a month. And it takes 14 to 21 days of it. So, we've had to fly it in from Thailand, which means that I begged our Australian donors who do this kind of thing, and I said, look, there's none in the country. Everything expired at the end of April. Every bit of it that they had in the country that the government had bought expired at the end of April and couldn't be used anymore. And nobody, since the government had it for like a year almost, none of the pharmacies had any in stock. They'd send it all back. So for 3 weeks, we're running around like maniacs, and then finally we set up a system where we're flying it in every time. We're flying in 200 bottles at a time, and, you know, the Australians are doing that, because 200 bottles is kind of the minimum you can fly in and have the medicine stay at those prices. If you can fly in 5,000 from India, you can get it for $13 each. But who can fly in 5,000 from India, and where are we? It's got to be kept at almost frozen. It's a powder, and if it gets warm, it's not frozen. So what do? We do all these things, and we study the Dhamma, you know. Every day we chant and we meditate, and on Wednesdays we meditate for 2 hours and have a snack and have a Dhamma talk, and then they practice their gorgeous chanting for a while. We've been studying the 4 foundations of mindfulness. This year we reviewed. Last year we just went through it once. Most of my staff are almost illiterate. They've had 2 or 3 years of school. So they learned how to read it aloud. And they learn how to make the connection between what they know from their meditation practice and their work with the patients to what the Buddha said. I don't know how many of you work with people who have always been told they're stupid and always been told they're inadequate. But for my staff to realize that they actually were practicing the way the Buddha said to practice and could understand what the Buddha said about that practice was transformative for them. So this year we did a review of the precepts and the paramitas and the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Brahma-Viharas, and then we went back. At that point, I was tired, and I said, why don't we do the Dhammapada? You know, the Dhammapada's fun. All those nice verses. And they said, no, we want the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So this time we're going through and we're working on the parts that they don't know about. And they're confident in their ability to learn them, and to learn them really, you know. And so that's wonderful. I get a real kick out of my staff. They're, most of you have heard this so many times. The first time I ever went into a patient, my staff was on. I don't get to see the patients very much. And, you know, my staff see them all the time. First time I ever went in, while my staff was on holiday, and went into a patient, and he said, "Where's Sun?" I was so hurt. So jealous. Sun is, like, really incredible. Okay, I mean, she's just absolutely bottomlessly incredible. We knew that when we hired her. We've known her for a number of years, and we've been waiting for the chance. You know, but she was dying of tuberculosis for a year, and we had to wait till that got better, and things like that. Anyway, so, of course they're better than me. They're Cambodian. They're working inside the society that they know. Half of them have AIDS. You know, all of those who've had AIDS have been very close to death and have lost people they were very close to. All of us at this point have lost people we've been very close to. But they're inside in a way that I'm not. And if they weren't better than me, then I wouldn't be doing my job. So my job is to support them. And our job is to do whatever comes up, to be present for whatever comes up, to see it. And then when we see it, and then when we see our own response to it, like we get really mad at the doctors who neglect the patients and things, when we see our own responses, we have some freedom about how to actually respond in the situation. If we don't allow ourselves to be present, we have no freedom at all. We're at the mercy of the stuff we're refusing to look at. When we can allow ourselves to be present, then we have a space where we can find a wiser course. Okay? So that's your yearly summary. It's been the year from hell. And my best friend, who is a social worker, clinical social worker, and trains counselors, and has been in Cambodia for more than 20 years, reads, writes, speaks impeccable Khmer, you know, is seeing my staff four afternoons while I'm away, so they can look at what they've been going through from a slightly different perspective. And also so that if they need to bitch about me, they've got a safe space to do it. Because they know she won't repeat anything they say. But they know that she would find a way to get information to me about changes that they may need to be made that they don't know how to tell me. So she's there because they're in ragged shape. We're all in ragged shape. It's not been the easiest year. The person who was coming in and training, supposed to come in, came in to train to possibly take over most of my job, was not suitable. I hadn't looked at her carefully enough. I hadn't been present for who she was. And so we had a hard couple of months while she was there. So it comes in not being present, dummy. So, yeah. Anything else? How are you guys? America's a rough place right now. How are you managing? I'm not joking. I think in a lot of ways we have it easier.
The government shut down
today. Yeah. Yeah. And our 501c3 is still in progress. And now we won't even be able to find out what's happening with it. Yeah. But you'll be happy to know that Homeland Security and the NSA are still operating. The military are operating, but they're not going to be paid till later. Who else is still operating? Social Security is still operating, you know. Some of the functions are still operating. Well, how do we pray? How do we be present for this? How do we be present for the huge disparities and the difficulties that people are facing around jobs, around deaths, around houses, around schooling? How do we be present for that? How do we be present? I mean, these are external conditions, but our ability to be present is what will help us find the wisdom to respond to them. And the lucky thing about the time we spend in meditation is that we don't spend our time on those things. We spend our time on breathing. We spend our time on being here. And that being here not only gives us a respite, but it gives us the strength to continue. I wish you all a very good year. And it's lovely to see you. And it's lovely to see you thriving. And, you know, I wish you very good luck in coping with what is seems to me a much harder situation than ours. You know, we don't have a government either right now because the opposition gained a lot of seats but wanted to have gained more and is refusing to participate and is calling for one more mass demonstration. The demonstrations have been pretty safe for the most part, but there was one that, you know, someone was killed and a lot of people were hurt at. Yeah.
We twice a year get a visitation from the Buddhist world, far from our own. And Dan Miller was here not that long ago, telling us about his experiences in China. And once a year, you come and let us know what's happening in Cambodia. And within the time period that we last saw you, things in Cambodia and in Burma made news here in America. Certainly Buddhist bloggers talked a great deal for about 3 months about what was happening in Burma.
Well, when the monks start, you know, using violence against the Muslims, that's pretty radical. That's happened in Sri Lanka a lot, where there's been Muslim Buddhist violence against the Hindus. But, you know, it's a tip of, you know, people talk about it like it's ancient enmity, but it's the, in a crisis, you turn on who you can turn on. You know, in times of economic crisis, domestic violence escalates. Violence against children escalates. When you can't, when you don't have, but what's astonishing to me in Burma is because the Buddhist training is so fine, I expect better from the monks there. And yeah. But it's I don't know. I come here and I hear so many terrible stories about what's happening in people's lives. And I think that as Americans, we are not brought up to have resilience in adversity. We're brought up to believe in success. And that that does not stand us in good stead in these times. But our practice will. Our practice will help us find the necessary ballast to remain sane in the world. And so we're very lucky, and you're extraordinarily lucky to have Angie from the teacher. She's like, I go a lot of places, and really, she's one of the absolute very best.
And you, there's no even way to say how inspirational you are for us, that you're able to do what you do.
Yeah.
And it's,
I tried to go straight
without without your example. We need examples for each other. And you just do it for us.
Well, what I do is, you know, we were talking at dinner. It's just what we do.
Yes.
It's just what we do. It's not, you know, when I started my project 15 years ago, we're ending our 14th year. Right? It was conceived in megalomania. And inspired by insanity. All right. And if I hadn't had some really good people, one of them being the head of the Mary Noel AIDS program, who was my unofficial supervisor for like 10 years, 9 years, we wouldn't have lasted a month. Because it gets beaten out of you pretty fast when you're working directly with what's going on. So, and then there's the patients. We had this terrific visitor this year. She was at Tassajara for a million years and Zen Center before that, and her name's Mako Boko, and she's about 41, and she just, and when she went to give a Dhamma talk at our staff, to my staff, what she did was ask them what it is that makes them able to continue the work. I mean, look, we've had an average of 3 to 5 deaths a week. And last week there were 6. In a patient load which is much smaller in a country that's pretending nobody's dying of AIDS. And, you know, one of the things, the first things they said outside of the Buddhism was the love they get from the patients. Yeah. And then, of course, when somebody gets better, like this guy with the cryptococcal and the wife who was 2 months pregnant, we got him the medicine and he's home and he's better and he's going to get on antiretrovirals and, you know. And her first AIDS test was negative, so she may actually be negative. It takes 3 tests to be sure in this situation. And now they know, and, you know. So, we all need and get inspiration all over the place. And our own lives seem ordinary to all of us. And it's a healthy thing.
Thank you for being our inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for getting inspired.
That part was easy.
You know.
Okay. Well, thank you for continuing to come also.
Oh. It's completely, utterly, bottomlessly selfish from the, you know, it comes from greed at the bottom of my not self. It's always a delight to be here.
And we can help you out through Empty Hands, isn't that right?
Yeah.
We can make donations to Empty
Hands. Yeah. And mark them for us. And that's on our website. Does anyone not know our website?
We got an email from Donald Lane, I think. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Gave us a link. So.
Yeah, it's way out of date. I haven't updated content except for the 2-page project description in 4 years.
It's got great pictures. Though.
It's got great pictures. We had this photographer who was going to come and spend a week, and he spent 3 months and got great, great, great pictures and has been back a few times since. So the pictures are cool. In the staff section especially. Yeah.
You need a documentarist, somebody who will come and illuminate what's happening in your world, mm-hmm. and get that message out to somebody more.
What message?
Well, I think there's a number of messages.
Actually.
So, your message, what you were just describing in terms of 5 people dying a week.
We can't get that publicized or we will be thrown out of the country. I will be thrown out of the country and my organization will be destroyed. The official word...
It remains in the darkness, somehow illuminated.
Well... You got to pick your battles. And, you know, Cambodia until 2010 was one of the absolute success stories, AIDS success stories in the world. And then the government took over. And they don't want to hear that it isn't still, even though they take the money that's supposed to go to medicine and, you know, buy new Lexuses with it. you know, nobody knows how much AIDS there is now. They use the old statistics, but nobody's getting tested. You know, the whole system of testing is collapsed. You know, that's the, I think it's very hard on my staff because, you know, there's only three of us who don't have AIDS. And it's really scary to see it go back to what it was 10 years ago, 12 years ago. When their husbands died or their wives died or their children died, and that's how they found out they had AIDS. And they nearly died. And now patients are coming in the condition they were in 2001, 2002. And we didn't see that for a lot of years. There were a whole lot of years when the programs were working and nobody got, you know, it's not that nobody got that sick. It's that so many fewer people got that sick because they got diagnosed early and their lives didn't collapse completely before they found out and got their antiretrovirals. And, you know, we've got 50,000 people on antiretrovirals in the country. Those are for those who don't know, those are the pills that will keep you able to live a normal life for a long time. Yeah. We've still got that. We've got another big group of people who are dying are people who aren't taking the pills. They get married again and they don't want their spouse to know, so they don't take their pills. And a year later, the spouse finds out because they're in the hospital. Or they feel fine and they go away for a job and it's too hard and they can't tell their bosses that they've got to go to Phnom Penh because it's going to take 2 days off of work and the bosses don't want to do that. And they don't want to tell their bosses they have AIDS because the bosses will fire them. You know, and a year later, they pay for that. And a lot of them pay for that with their lives. And some of them don't. Some of them recover. But what's happening here in this country to the poor with AIDS? What's happening as the medical services are done? With the poor with everything. With the increase in tuberculosis, with the increase in child mortality. You know, there are parts of this country that have infant mortality rates that are the equivalent of anywhere in the third world. Sorry. But there's a book coming out. It's called In a Rocket Made of Ice. It will be out in fall of 2014. It's about the Wat'opat Children's Community, which is a project we're very close to. Written by a woman who has spent a lot of time there. It is a wonderful book to read. It will just, and unlike some of these books that have come out and gotten very famous, it's actually true. So Pico Iyer has written a thing, blurb for it. And Anne Fadiman, who wrote The Spirit Moves You When You All Fall Down, has written a blurb for it. And Paul Farmer, Partners in Health, Haiti, AIDS and Accusation, the person who convinced the WHO to put multidrug-resistant tuberculosis into its programs. Paul Farmer has written the introduction, and I have written the preface. And the discussions with Knopf I mean, the decision, but it's being published first in Japan by Kyoto Press. And that's going to be a small edition now that will be available in Japan and Cambodia. But the managing editor of Knopf loved it. And 3 days ago we heard that it's going to be out, and they're going to rush it because the woman who wrote it has cancer. And they want to get it out as quickly as possible because they want her to be able to go on book tours. And she said, well, if you want me to go on book tours, you better hurry. But if you hear about it, you know, that's a book that's going to just get to you, man. Because she loves the kids so much, and she has such a beautiful feeling for language. And the project is like completely, you know. Guy who founded it was raised heavy-duty fundamentalist. Church across the street is going to hell because they're wrong Christian. And came to Cambodia and formed something called Partners in Compassion with a Buddhist guy. And they found this land at the back of a lot that they could use for a hospice and for a project. And Wayne had been a medic in Vietnam, and he'd worked on Native American reservations, and he'd worked in Honduras or Belize or someplace, and he'd worked lots of places. Always with the poorest, always, you know. And so they ran a hospice for quite a while, and a little hospital in connection with the regional hospital. And then about 2005, when things were really good and the death rate was way down and the hospitals were really functioning, Wayne had like collected all these children who came in with their dying parents. And they were caregivers for their dying parents, and then nobody wanted them, and some of them had AIDS and some of them didn't. By that time he had about 50 of them, and he said, these kids have seen enough dying, closing down the hospice, and we're just going to raise the kids. And now he's got kids who are in, one of them is in a very fancy high-level art school, like the best art school in Phnom Penh. A couple of them are in university. A number of them are working. You know, they go to school, they get to grow up. Some have AIDS, some don't. Nobody makes distinctions. They get a lot of visitors. He's very visitor-friendly. So the kids learn a lot of English. And they learn a little German, French. A lot of English. And a lot of extras, like someone goes down and teaches art there. And someone teaches music. And the book is all about this stuff, and it's just going to be wonderful. It's just so cool that they're doing it. And I feel very, very lucky that... Yeah, bye-bye. Yeah, I'm going on forever. It's 8:26, guys. Yeah. So... we should probably stop. I'm just nattering away.
Thank you.
Thank you guys. You just keep doing it here, because if this country could become even marginally sane, the effect on the whole world would be very important. If you only would not start another war. You know? Okay. I mean, yeah. I mean, Syria was a very good start. It's a very good precedent. How many other wars can you keep from happening? What about the Keystone Pipeline? What about fracking? Yeah. What about having air and water and land, and bees, and birds, and animals for your grandchildren, and everybody else's grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, the Hubble telescope's got 300,000 galaxies, but we live in this one. So your practice, the sanity that comes from the practice, can provide at least a little bit of counterweight to all this stuff. Yeah. We don't practice, we're Mahayanists. We don't just practice so we can go off to Nirvana and everybody else can rot. Which is not what the Dharma actually practice either. But we practice so that everything can be released from suffering.